the origins of the Evans family, and it was traced back to Wales.
Yes, and basically they settled in Yorktown, but Yorktown was basically, I guess you could call it a experiment in death, because most of the people didn't survive Yorktown. You know, they starved out, they never received materials from supplies from England and so forth. So there's a lot of things about Yorktown that are hard to trace back. But in any case, this young lady starts off doing that. This also, she documents us all, she documents her family all the way up to when her family started marrying Indians. And then Indians, we branch off from the Indian side, the white Indian side of the Evanses, and she carries her family all the way to present, and we carry our family all the way to present based on those documentations. So this book gives you an example of how we go from Wales to Yorktown and then throughout the North Carolina and to all of the states that we presently live in.
Okay.
This document right here starts, our descendants started at 1695.
Wow.
Well, it actually started at 1675 when this guy was born.
In Yorktown.
In Virginia, in York County. And they don't document where he was. They document his court case where he had he went to court over a debt, and so it documents him from that point. But it starts back in the 16 somethings and goes to here and the 2002. And basically, this document starts at our basic history, which starts at Charlie and Matilda, which is the branches that settle in Chatham County. They go from Chatham County to Cary, and then from Cary, to wherever we are now. But this goes back to present, because Charlie and Matilda, they died in like 19, I don't know exactly when they died, but let's see, when did Charlie and Matilda die? It doesn't. It says it in here, but
okay.
But in any case, I've got to find out. I think they died in like 45 or something like that, of 1945, 1936. Then it goes back to Clyde Evans, which you know about.
Yes, I
okay.
am indeed.
Then
his son. Well, this is your grandfather.
This is my grandfather.
Senior.
Okay. Then it goes to the Bailey family.
Yes.
Then it goes to this subdivision, which is on my grandfather's land. Then it goes to some of the problems that we were having in the rezoning with the town of Cary.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that is another story which I have been involved in very heavily.
Okay.
To give you an idea of what we've been doing, I'll go back to where I live presently.
Okay.
And if you want to bring your recorder over here, or if you want to stop it, that's fine. But I can give you an idea.
Okay. I think it'll pick up.
Probably
if
we're staying on the
ground
floor here.
Okay. What we have right here is this is Granny's own land. Granny bought about 100 acres here. And then my grandfather lived to be about 93.
Wow.
And then he passed it on to my mom and all of the relatives. Well, the thing about this thing is very important is that my particular area of the family, the Bailey's, have been, as with my grandfather and his father before him, have been very tied to the land. We basically start our values based on land, as the people in Africa start their values based on cattle and so forth. So we have tried to retain land ownership as one of our principal basic values. And as far as I'm concerned, I try not to sell land. I'm a builder, so therefore I sell a building on the land before I sell any land. Very rarely have we tried to sell land unless it's tied to a home that we constructed or something like that. But that's my father, Joseph H. Bailey.
Okay.
This is my grandfather's home right here, Clyde and Romeo Evans.
Yeah, Joe.
Okay. And, let's see here. Okay, we got those on.
Okay.
What's going on that lead?
Good. Oh, okay.
All right, let me go back to this.
Okay.
All right.
So the one was showing me this drawing by Jared Miller, and that was that. The homestead that was on this land?
Yes,
that
it was.
Standing on right now?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, actually, it is near the house that my first cousin, who has passed away in a motorcycle accident, bought. Okay?
Oh.
And it's near where my brother, now presently, owns a house.
Okay.
All right. So, in Evans Estate, which is on my grandfather's if we have lots reserved for Brittany Bailey, as well as we have a aunt that owns a lot here in Evans Estates as well, that she will eventually, or her sons will eventually build it. So there will always be an Evans on Evans Road, on your Evans Road, as far as we're concerned, from here to wherever. But this is my grandfather's house. And we tore this house down. I took a log that was hewed by my grandpa and took it out of that house. And from that house, I took it and put it in this house. Now, in architecture design, you have what structural members call your foundation and so forth. And part of the foundation work is foundation that carries point loads. Point loads is the designation of a structure member that is vertical, that transfers the load to another structure member all the way. Well, I placed that beam under my house, right there.
So the beam is right underneath your staircase right there?
Uh-huh, right at that corner. That corner carries a point load from right there to that corner, which carries my floor.
Okay.
That corner carries the point load up to the ceiling, which carries my roof.
Okay.
So I have now established a foundation based on my grandfather.
Oh.
From the basement of my house all the way to the roof.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So that's how we did it. Now, we have the picture of my grandfather, which you see with his dog.
Yes.
My grandmother.
Sissy.
And these two pictures of my grandmother and my grandfather. And this one right here is called Granny's Last Stand. Well, Granny's Last Stand, you see those old trees?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those up there.
Right outside your front door. Look at that.
And that was the barn over there. It runs from my house.
Okay.
So the barn was built typically of what my grandfather used. And all the buildings that had happened, you watch. And I think all the
They bought the first land in 1890?
No, they didn't. They bought, Charlie and Matilda bought they moved from Chatham County to here. And Mama could give you a little bit more information. And I think it's written in here when Charlie and Matilda came to Chatham County.
Okay.
Okay. Charlie and Matilda is licensed very new, so and so. Okay. Charlie purchased 75 additional acres and bringing the total to 100. This is right here. Okay. They had 75 acres of land. Initially, they bought for $10.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Now, this is Charlie and Matilda.
Yes.
All right. And this is located in the Evans Estates. Not in Evans Estates. Over there off of Apex. In Apex.
In Apex. Okay.
No, not in Apex. In Cary, but off of over there near our family cemetery.
Oh, on Old Apex Road.
On Old Apex Road.
Okay, near High House?
Near High House.
Yes, okay.
You been over there?
No, I think your mother was telling me about that. So now that was in the late 1800s, probably?
Yes, yeah. And my grandfather bought his land in... I can't remember.
So that would be Charlie.
No. Yeah.
Clyde.
Yeah, Clyde.
Clyde.
Clyde bought 100 acres on Evans Road.
Okay. Do you know who they bought the land from?
No, but you can find that out from the county records. You can look in county records and see that.
Oh, okay.
By visiting Wake County .gov and the rest of your deeds.
Oh, okay.
So you can pull that up. You can trace it back. You can look back at the grandma and granny and look back at Clyde Evans and then search his records back to there.
Okay.
And pull the documents out of it.
Let's see. Okay. Okay.
I've never done it. I mean, I've done it for houses that I bought or properties that I bought, but I never tried to trace the family, the deeds back to that. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave that with you.
Okay. Wonderful.
And then I was going to see if you wanted to take a brief ride for about 10 minutes and I'll show you what we've been doing.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Well, we can put this.
This is Peggy Vance Gregg. Earlier today, I was in the home of Mr. George Bailey, and he was talking to me and telling me about his family. His grandfather was Clyde Evans Sr. His mother is Mamie Bailey, who is the sister of Clyde Evans Jr., and George lives in Cary in Evans Estates that he and his brothers helped develop, worked together to develop. So what you heard previously was the beginning of his interview. We are going to reconvene in a few days to pick up where we left off. In the meantime, he has loaned me a number of books and genealogical studies that have been done on the Evans family, so that I can go through them and compile a list of questions for him about his family. So we will be getting back to that topic when we meet again. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, 2009, and we are going to continue our interview today with George Bailey at his home. So we will begin shortly.
Interesting. About desegregations and the problems that we as family have had, and not necessarily Evans's, but in general, what people and you know, I do read a lot, and I'm sure you read a lot of things that I've read, like Colin Powell's book and Condoleezza Rice's book, but some of the interesting facts about racism and so forth deal with how racism occurred over history, the history of the United States. One of the more fascinating group of books that I've read is Mitchell's books. The Source, which is about the Jewish experience in Israel and Palestine, but also about Hawaii, Chesapeake, and all of these sort of books portrays racism in various forms of America being conquered, of the progression of Europeans throughout the United States, and also as far as Hawaii was concerned, you know. But that is interesting. And my dad used to tell me stories, and one of them that I remember very well was pertaining to some of the more important figures here in North Carolina, being that my father was always an entrepreneur, and you know, owned his own companies, and since about 63, you know, starting with plumbing companies that did major complexes. This is how I got into the business as well, because when I was 13, actually when I was about 12, my father put me to work as a plumber. And by the time I was 15, I had 4 people working for me. And what I would do is I was in charge of apartment complexes, where I would put in all the fixtures and so forth for apartment complexes. And some of these guys were 40 years old. But going back to my dad, one of the largest builders in North Carolina when he was doing his, you know, construction work, and he was basically doing utilities, running underground water pipe and sewer pipe. But one of his contractors was Willie York. Okay, now Willie York's son is Sneed York. Okay, which is the mayor, the mayor of Rye. Well, Willie York, and this is not one of those good stories, but it tells you how he played in the scenario of segregation. Well, Willie York, Daddy was on one of his jobs, and he had a contract with Willie York. And one day, Willie York, with a group of other white men around him, called Daddy 2 or 3 times the N-word. Okay? And it was pertaining to something on the job. You blah blah this, you blah blah that. And basically, he, you know, at that time, you know, segregation, Jim Crow was heavy in Raleigh, North Carolina. Because Daddy had problems in several aspects of as far as it was pertaining to Raleigh. But Willie York did that. You know, Daddy was a very shrewd man, and for somebody that had a ninth grade education, you know, he excelled in business, and when he passed away, you know, I'll put it this way, he wasn't poor, okay? But that, as well as some of the other things, my daddy was trying to get his journeyman card in the city of Raleigh, and while he was trying to do this, they had a series of tests which required that you had to pour some and wipe some lead joints. Well, he knew that he had passed this exam, but he had to take it over 3 times. The third time they finally gave, it was this persistence that allowed him to get his license to make his livelihood. From there he started Capital City Plumbing, which went into utilities and various other things. And the unique thing about my dad is that he always knew when he couldn't handle something, hire somebody else to do it that had more sense than he did. So, you know, when ran into a problem, he had several businesses in which he had a white partner, and he owned 51% of the white partner, but he was not out in the front on any of the businesses. You know, he was background. You couldn't be out, being black, you couldn't be out in front on a major business in North Carolina. That just wasn't going to cut it, you know. And you know, as times got better, he had his other companies that he was out on front on, but he had partnerships with various companies. One of them was B&B Paving, for example. My father used to own 51% of B&B Paving, which, you know, did 15-20 million a year. I don't know what they did now. I shouldn't say 15-20. I don't know what they did, because I used to work for them briefly. But Daddy did a lot of stuff. Mama basically handled the office and so forth, and because my mother, you know, as I told you before, my mother graduated from college the same day that my oldest brother graduated from high school, so she went back to school to get an education,
which is admirable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he had to learn how to work the system.
He had to work the system. He had to work the system, and you know, he, you know, town of Cary wouldn't be proud of that, but I know of occasion where my daddy delivered $100 bills to get things approved through the town of Cary. I mean, during the time that bribes were allowed, they are not allowed now. But, you know, during the time that he was being brave, you know, trying to get stuff through town of Cary that he wanted, you know, you had to bribe people.
Wow.
Yeah, to the tune of $5,000.
Wow.
But this is dead history, you know, because probably the person that he bribed as well as himself are now deceased.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that...
Now, did white contractors have to bribe as much?
Well, I don't know. You know, we weren't white, so...
So you don't know.
We don't know. But, you know, they had contact with everyone in the town of Cary and donated money to the fire department and so forth. But as far as segregation as it was, we were kept on the toe. We you know, we went to all segregated schools, but we were never out in the forefront of anything. I mean, we constantly worked, so we didn't have time to be politicians. The Evans, as you know, weren't really politicians as such, out there in the forefront of the desegregation movement and so forth. We experienced it, but you know, we were sheltered from it by our upbringing, as you could say. And Daddy had to confront it every day in his businesses, in dealing with people. And my mother only confronted it, you know, on small occasion, because she was not out there in the business world. And are we out there in situations where where segregation slapped us upside the head, you know, where we were out there and so forth. Because, you know, at the time where we were being raised, you know, we didn't go out to eat. We ate at home. You know, that's just so many elements into being raised in this area that you know, my family didn't do.
So, what was it like in Cary itself?
Well,
Raleigh being the capital city is one thing, but Cary is more small town.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was raised when the road was gravel.
Okay.
So, the bus picked me up and carried me to school.
And you went to school in Raleigh?
No, I went to school in Cary up to when I was 12 years old.
Oh, okay.
All right, so I was about in the fifth grade, and my mother had a problem with the principal of the school that we were going to, which was a segregated school. And she chose to pull all of us out that were in that system, all the way starting from my sister, all the way down to the youngest. And then we moved to Raleigh. Now, we had two homes in Cary, but education was so important to her that we moved from Cary to Raleigh into the projects until we could buy a house, and we lived in the projects about 3 months. So I never went to school, I never was raised per se in Cary. We moved away. Now my brother Herbert was raised throughout his educational experience to high school in Cary, and he drove a school bus. And that was one of the reasons I indicated that I think you need to talk to him, because he was older and he probably has different experiences than I. Because one of the things that happened during the time that I was being raised is that the movement started, and the identity of people started changing. An example of that would be, I never thought I was Indian. I always thought I was black. All right. But the reality, if you were to slice me up into pieces and say, well, what is my percentage of this blood or that blood or whatever, you would find that that black would be the smallest of my percentages. But the reality was, is I was raised in a black environment where, you know, I knew I was beautiful, you know. And so my confidence level in that environment as the movement started and the schools that I went to, which is A&T, was, you know, I mean, it just compounded that. I mean, there was nothing I couldn't do, you know. You know, when I finished college, you know, I went off to Peace Corps. You know, that is something that black folk don't do. I was one among three out of 150 people.
You were one?
I was one among three out of 150. There were three black individuals in the Peace Corps Ethiopia, out of 150. Oddly enough, those same three people, after the 2-year contract, finished up their contract with the United States government. And I say that why it's important is because when I left, out of the 150, only 70 were still completed their contract. So those people that the individuals that were black in our organization had 100% completion rate of their contract, wherein the other individuals, which were 99.9% of the remaining total, were white. Only less than 50% finished up their contract. And it was all about the association with people and then being able to adapt. You know, being black puts you in a situation where you have to adapt to other cultures that have been dictated to you, other environments that you are being constantly thrust in. And so, you know, as I look back at it, you know, the reason that I survived my 2-year contract was very simple. I did not come over to Africa thinking that I was an American. I did not come over to Africa thinking I was a black American. I came over to Africa to help. And I did not let my American attitude adjust me, adjust, try to adjust the country to me. I let the country adjust me. And so when I had to sit in the building for 3 hours to get somebody to sign a piece of paper, I brought a book. And I patiently sat there for 3 hours, wherein some other people got so upset that they couldn't get something done that, you know, it bothered them. It put a lot of stress on. I didn't. You know, it didn't bother me.
It's the way it's done here.
It was the way it's done. So I didn't go in there trying to change Ethiopia to make it a little America. And I was successful in completing my 2-year contract.
Now, why did you choose to go into the Peace Corps in the first place?
I have never in my life not planned what I wanted to do since I've been conscious, many years in advance. I knew what I wanted to do to major in college 4 years before I got to college. I knew when I was in college, when I saw an advertisement, that's what I'm going to do. And I set my goals up. I knew that when I left Peace Corps, I was going to be back in 4 years. I was back in 4 years. I knew when I was coming from Peace Corps what I wanted to do. As soon as I hit the ground in America, after I finished up a consultancy contract for USAID, I started a company and was back in business. I have never, almost through my entire life, worked for anybody, white, green, or orange. I worked for myself. The Peace Corps, I was independent. Almost everywhere I have, almost anything that I've done, I've never really had a boss. And it creates attitudinal problems now. My wife would be the first one to tell you I got an attitude. But the reality is I haven't had a situation where I'm adjusting to other people. I'm telling other people what to do. You know, I started off all my life doing that. When I was 15 years old, I had somebody working for me. And so that history has always put me in conflict with people. One, because I don't know how to come. You know, I've had employees all my life, except for a relationship with my wife. You know, my kids, I still try to tell them to do what to do. They're grown. They just don't even listen to me no more. But that's the emphasis. And my whole family, all of the Baileys are to a degree like that. We've been in business or around business all our life, and we have migrated toward that. And when we have worked for other people, we're like the Jamaicans or the Puerto Ricans. We have 3 jobs. My sister has rolled 3 jobs, you know, quite a bit in her life. If she wants a Mercedes-Benz, get another job. All right? I mean, and she said several Mercedes-Benz. But the point is, we were always raised in working, and we have always been around an opportunity where someone has progressed and that someone has made money to identify the road to us. It is a very narrow road that anyone travels in faith in whatever you want to do. And if you have the discipline to follow a narrow road, it is almost always going to be successful. You know, my brother taught for a few years in D.C. And when he came back here, he hit the ground running. Business time, started his business. My other brother, he worked for executive with GE for a while, and they moved him around the state, the United States for a while, but, you know, started his own business. My sister does taxes on the side. She's in real estate, so she got her own business. So it's just a part of life. From that
it's a big part of your family culture.
Oh yeah. You know, my grandfather was always, he never called himself a farmer. He disliked that term. He was a public man. Now he did a lot of farming. My grandfather had a big garden. He had corn out in front of some of these houses where the subdivisions is. He raised tobacco, but he was not a farmer. He was a public man. And you know, that was his attitude. He just didn't you know, he could not relate to being a farmer as his occupation. But he you know, like I said, he raised pigs, he did as many people did. And he sold his produce as well.
But he also did a lot of timber.
Oh yeah, he did a lot of timber. You know, I helped him as a child, and his brother worked for him, which is Tillman, and which is the property that the cemetery is on. Okay, so you got to remember that Charlie and Matilda came from Chatham County to Cary, North Carolina, and they bought the original blocks of land over there near Dutchess Village, which is the subdivision we developed, and where the cemetery is. And then my grandfather bought this land over here, and then some of his brothers migrated over here, which is, you know, Herbert Evans's family, the Loveless Evans's family, which is his brother, and so forth. And some of the, you know, so that chain stays over here. So then when he migrated over here, they bought land over here either from him or somebody else. I'm not sure. But then the his clan, his group of family member migrated here, and that's where, you know, the Clyde Evans. But we originally came from Chatham County. Now, interestingly enough, my brother's been buying land in Chatham County. He has 200 and some acres in Chatham County. But the Chatham County connection is one that we have not thoroughly investigated for the Charlie Evans side that stayed in Chatham County. Because when they moved from West Virginia as landowners, they moved to Chatham County to buy land, and then the Chatham County folks moved to Cary to buy land. So there is undoubtedly, if it's our Evans spirit running, our Evans blood still running in their veins, we have some of our relatives in Chatham County that own land. And you know, as free slaves, because basically Evans chained, were all free, not necessarily freed slaves, but freed Indians that married into free slaves are the people that were in slavery. Some of it, the chains, you know, I don't match up, basically, but most of it came from all free people.
Right, so the Evans family throughout, they were never slaves.
Not that I know of.
That's what it said, too, in the articles that you've been able to find through your genealogy as
right.
well. But they may have married ex-slaves or free
yes.
slaves.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you don't know that side of the family that still may be in Chatham County.
Don't know. Yeah. But we do know all the chain as it goes from Charlie and Matilda, which, you know, started back in the 1800s.
Most of them are still right around here, it sounds like.
Yeah, quite a few. I mean, we're all over. I mean, we have one of my cousins she's retired now, but she was the head of the legal department that defends criminals in California, in the capital. There are articles that my mom has in one of her papers, but she won awards and so forth. The public defender, she was the department head for the public defenders in the what's the capital of California?
Sacramento.
Sacramento. And so you know, we you know, we have airline pilots or military people that flew planes and did this. I mean, we're all over the map. As anybody's family is, I think the generation after Clyde Evans is a multifaceted generation that is into everything that any family would be into. Because then we have no limits. You know, education is then as far as you want to carry. We have nothing stopping us. And you know, some of this is nothing stopping us from the areas that we're in. Because when migration took up north, there are less limits put on you as far as the Southern Jim Crow laws and so forth. So you have an opportunity, you know, like Condoleezza Rice, you know, to excel in Denver, where she was, you know, she didn't have to worry about segregated schools. She didn't have to worry about bombings. She didn't have to worry about anything. She might have been the only one in the class, but just the same, you know, black kids are the only one in the class here in North Carolina all the time. My kids were raised the only one in the class. I mean, it's the way of life. If you excel in education, you're going to be, there's going to be a limited number that are excelling, and we're the smallest of the population here, so you know, we're going to be a small amount.
That's true.
Yeah.
Now, where did your children go to school?
They all went to Broughton High School.
To Broughton.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was not in their district, but my wife was able to get them into Broughton, but being an educator. So they all went to Broughton. They were all guided by Miss Linda as far as education. Like I said, education was a priority, and it was a they never thought of nothing but college, you know. They were at a very early age trying, you know, involved in college life. They received scholarships from A&T, both of them, because I had Linda's sister was a professor there. So we got scholarships from A&T, but none of them chose to go to A&T. And their basic reason was that they had experienced the college life through us. I graduated from A&T. I have three other brothers and sisters that graduated from A&T. So they were at A&T all the time. So they chose State, Carolina, and UNCG.
Oh, okay. So the UNC system.
Yeah.
UNC State. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Broughton was integrated by the time they got there, right?
Well, every school was integrated long before that. When I was 18 when I was through the last class of Ligon, which became integrated in 1979, all right, wherein I was in the last class of it being an all-black school.
Okay.
All right, but my brothers and sisters, after Ligon was integrated, they went to Enloe because we lived over there near Enloe.
Okay.
And with that in mind, so that stopped the chain of all-black schools right there in our family. So from my brothers and sisters, from myself up, which I'm the middle child, we went to all black schools. From and they're down with all white schools basically. And all my kids went to all white schools.
Okay.
All mixed schools.
Right.
You know, because at that time the school system was Wake County and not Raleigh. When I was in school, it was all Raleigh City schools that I was going to.
Okay.
And where my brother went to all Wake County schools, because he went to Beryl Kelly, which was the only black school, only black high school in this area.
Right, okay.
In Wake County.
Okay, yeah. So your children went to elementary school in Cary, but by that time?
No.
I was in
Raleigh. This is 20 years later.
Okay.
So you know, we're talking about a big gap in America. My kids were in. I never grew up with anybody white. All right, my kids grew up with friends that we came by this and that. Even though we lived in basically in a black community, their association was very white. Their structure of involvement was very white. You know, Tiny was on the Raleigh Flute Association. And being the only black, she was the only black on that. I mean, they were involved in any and everything, but the many of the associations may have been black, but their involvement was you know, with the full culture rather than with a segregated culture.
Right, okay. Yeah, so very different experience from yours growing up.
Their whole attitude toward everything is different, you know. My attitude is always one of caution, you know. I've seen my father had a job in Johnson County, which was the racist, you know, and it was during the time where you could see the Ku Klux Klan in Johnson County with the big old sign they had out in the field on 64, on 70, it was on 70. This Johnson County, the home of the KKK. All right, now I grew up with that, but see, we were, our daddy had a job down at the prison system where there's a prison right there in Johnson County. I can't remember the name of it, but it's near a little town, and I can't remember the name of it. But in any case, he had three pieces of equipment that somebody poured sugar in. Now, sugar, if you're knowledgeable, sugar is one of the most damaging ingredients that you could put in a fuel tank. That means that you have to almost tear the whole engine down, the fuel system down. It actually makes a piece of equipment worthless. Because if you run it long enough, you just can't repair it. You have to basically throw it away. And so we had three pieces of equipment that someone put sugar in. And I know what it was. It was racism. You know, there was a lot of people down there that didn't like that my father won the contract. And so, you know, they put sugar in there. So I was raised up in that, wherein there was subtle, I would think, and I don't want to speak for my twins or my daughters. I don't want to say that they experienced the same kind, but I know there were things in their life that confronted them that identified segregation. And you know, the same teachers were teaching then as they were in now. And you know, there's a lot of things you can say that imply segregation, you know. And you know, I am sure that they experienced, but they are children of a family that was educated. And so they didn't necessarily have to call us to confront anything that they knew how to confront it themselves. They didn't have a problem with challenging any teacher if they thought their grade was not appropriate. And they had done, sometimes they would tell us, come back and say, they would tell us and they would ask us what they should do. But it was always that they didn't ask us to handle the problem. They solved the problems themselves. Wherein we didn't have to come in there and talk to the principal and get into somebody's face involved in this and call it what it was. They confronted the situation and they handled it, and they wouldn't stop if it didn't end up at the results that they wanted. And so they would call in the teacher to the principal if it was necessary. They didn't ever have to do that. It always stopped with the teacher because they never went in unprepared. You know, they didn't select that their grade was not good enough because of the teacher saying they was black. They knew what everybody else made. They read everybody else. These are their friends, white, green, orange. They knew what everybody else made. So they came in prepared to discuss and defeat the teacher in that particular situation. And therefore, they were able. I have never known any situation where they got a grade that they thought wasn't fair. And we never had to get involved in it.
No.
Because they chose to handle it themselves. Now, if they couldn't handle it, then that's where I would become involved in. Or Linda. I think Linda would have been more effective than I at it, because she knows the educational system a lot better, being an educator for 27 years.
So, did your father ever have to get involved with those kinds of confrontations for your maybe your siblings who were in integrated schools?
No, I don't recall that. Now you would have to ask them. Now we my father came to the school openings, the parent teacher conferences, and so forth. All of us were. Not the greatest of students, I would say. I don't think I was the greatest of students. I was, you know, I was one of my father's best workers, but I was not the greatest of students. You know, I stayed on the B side, you know, wherein I never did very well in English, but I excelled in mathematics and chemistry and physics and stuff like that, you know. So I was always a two-sided student. I get C's and D's and stuff that I wasn't very good in, and I get A's and B's. So it sort of balanced itself out. But I always had direction and purpose. I knew where I wanted to go to school, and I knew what it took to get in there, and I never had any problem, and I did fairly well on SATs and things of that sort. But I could never handle